evening from me, Jean Badenhorst, on Fine Music Radio, and welcome to this evening's edition of People of Note, in which we invite interesting people into the studio to talk about themselves, the interesting things they do, and of course, the music they like. My guest this evening is Professor Owen Dean, Professor of Intellectual Property Law at the University of Stellenbosch. Welcome, Owen.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Introducing Owen is quite a challenge, but I'm going to do my best to give you a bird's eye view, as it were. Owen, you are reliably known as the leading expert in the field of intellectual property law in South Africa today. You are the first and present incumbent of the Intellectual Property Chair at the Law Faculty of Stellenbosch University, the Anton Mostert Chair, which was donated by Dr. Johann Rupert, who is also Chancellor of Stellenbosch University and Executive Chairperson and CEO of Richemont. You were previously a senior partner, now a consultant, of leading intellectual property attorneys Spoor & Fisher. Your areas of specialization include trademark and copyright law. You served on the government's advisory committee on intellectual property law for 20 years and as chairman of the copyright subcommittee. A past president of the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law, you've written a number of books and journal articles, including the Handbook of South African Copyright Law, which was recently relaunched by JUTA late last year, and you're a frequent speaker on intellectual property matters at seminars and conferences. Now, it was during your full-time tenure at Spoor & Fisher, Owen, that a particularly interesting and what was to become high-profile case crossed your path. But before we get down to the details of that fascinating story and the book you've written about it, could you tell us, first of all, how you came to be in the field of intellectual property law at all?
Well, it's actually quite interesting because it all happened rather by accident or by sequence of circumstances. I went to Stellenbosch University and did a law degree with a government bursary. And in terms of my bursary arrangement, I had to work for some branch of the government for 6 years. So when I graduated at the end of 5 years sporting my LLB degree, I had to decide which government department to go into. And the choices were the Department of Justice, in which case I probably would have become a prosecutor in Pofada or somewhere, or alternatively the Department of Foreign Affairs, the diplomatic service, which seemed far more attractive and far more interesting way to spend 6 years. So I joined the Department of Foreign Affairs and spent 6 years in the department, and four of those years were spent at the South African Embassy in The Hague in Holland. Now, although I found the diplomatic service interesting and challenging and really enjoyed the 4 years I was in Holland, I really felt that law was my first love and that was where I should be. So I made up my mind that when I got back from Holland, I would look into the possibilities of getting into legal practice. By that time, I was married with two children. My youngest child at that stage was only 6 weeks old. So there was no chance of my wife going out to work. So I was going to have to find a position as an articled clerk, because I wanted to become an attorney, at a salary on which I could support a wife and two children. And at that stage, articled clerks were being paid the princely sum of 100 rand a month, which even in those days wasn't a lot of money. And in fact, I couldn't exist on 100 rand a month. I was earning at that time around 350 rand a month at the Department of Foreign Affairs, and I regarded that as being on the breadline. So I set myself the objective that I would have to get articles at least 350 rand a month. So off I went, hopefully to go and see law firms in Cape Town, Johannesburg, Pretoria, where I was based, having returned from abroad with Foreign Affairs. And everywhere I went, I got the same reaction, namely, we'd be happy to take you on at 100 rand a month, but for 350 rand a month, we can take three articled clerks, and we can't justify paying that sort of money for an articled clerk. And I began to despair that I would ever be able to realize this ambition of going into legal practice. But at the same time, I was looking to buy a house in Pretoria because I obviously had to live somewhere, having come back from overseas. And the estate agent who took me around empathized with my problem, and he said to me, well, I actually know an attorney who I'm sure will have a different, more sort of broader-minded approach to this issue, I'll arrange for you to see him, which he did. And I went to see Sunny Hart of the firm Friedland Hart and Partners in Pretoria, and I met with Sunny Hart and told him my story and got exactly the same response, namely, we'll take you on for R100 a month. Then he said to me, as almost as an afterthought, he said to me, I have a son, Laurie Hart, who is a partner of Spur and Fisher, who are patent attorneys. Have you ever given any thought to being a patent attorney? And I quite truthfully answered no, because frankly I didn't even know what a patent attorney did. So he said to me, look, patent attorneys work on an international level, and it may be that your international experience will sort of be of greater value to a patent firm than it would be to a domestic South African attorney's firm. I'll arrange for you, or I'll tell my son that you are looking for a position, which he did. And a few weeks later, I got a phone call from Laurie Hart, and he asked me to come in for an interview, and we chatted, and I told him my, by now, a very familiar story to me anyway. And at the end of it all, he said, well, R350 is not a stumbling block as far as we're concerned. And to cut a long story short, they took me on at my R350 a month. So there I found myself working as an article clerk with a patent law firm. I knew nothing about patents. I knew nothing about intellectual property at all. So it was a real learning curve for me. And initially my thinking was, well, I mean, this is clearly the last and perhaps only opportunity I'm going to get to be able to do articles. So I'm going to take it with both hands. Once I've done my articles, if I want to move on, so be it. But as I got into working with intellectual property, I found that it was actually very much to my liking. And in retrospect, I actually can't think of another branch of the law which I would have more enjoyed doing. And so really through these rather strange set of circumstances, I seemed to find my niche in life, which is a very happy story for me.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history,
and,
so they say.
And here you still have your wonderful association with Spur and Fisher after all these years and in your consultancy.
Well, by now I've become a real devotee of the gospel of intellectual property. So I almost eat, sleep, and drink it, and I'm sure my wife will testify to that.
Now, Owen, to give our listeners a clue as to the story that you're going to tell us this evening, after that enchanting introduction of your very own story, you have yet another story to tell. You've brought along with you this evening no less than 4 versions of one song, which was at the center of a high-profile case, the case to which I referred earlier. The 4 versions illustrate an evolution of the original. So let's listen now to the 2 earliest versions. Tell us about those 2 early versions, what we're going to hear.
Well, the case you're referring to dealt with the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which ultimately ended up in the Walt Disney production of The Lion King. Now, unbeknown to most people, this song actually had a South African origin. It was originally sung and recorded in the 1930s by a gentleman called Solomon Linder. And he actually wrote the song, and he called it Mbube. And then through a strange set of circumstances, this piece of music, or Solomon Linder's version of it, ended up in America, where it came to the attention of Pete Seeger, and he liked the song. He had no sheet music for it, so he transcribed from the recording that he had heard the song, and he brought it out as a song which he called Wimaway. And as Wimaway, it really hit the high spots and became a hit in the 1950s, 60s, thereabouts. So that's the first 2 versions. The first is the original Wimaway, and the second is Pete Seeger's adaptation of it into Wimaway, which ultimately gives rise to a copyright infringement claim, which is where we're heading.
So let's listen to those 2 versions.
We move them.
Our guest this evening is Professor Owen Dean, Professor of Intellectual Property Law at the University of Stellenbosch. Owen has just introduced us to two versions of The Lion's Song, Mbube, performed by the composer in the first version you heard, Solomon Linder, and his group, The Songbirds, and Pete Seeger's version of what he heard on that recording as Wimowe. Pete Seeger was an American folk singer, and he was singing there with the Weavers. Owen, tell us about how these two recordings became such a central part of your professional life for almost 7 years, from roughly the year 2000 through to 2006.
Well, what happened was, historically what happened was that Solomon Linder wrote this piece of music. It was recorded in the 50s by Gallo. Gallo sent it over to the United States. hoping that Decca, with whom they had an association, would pick up on some of their recordings. This was not the only thing they sent over. They sent up a whole batch of recordings. And Decca didn't really like anything that they heard. But somewhere, someone thought that maybe Pete Seeger might have some interest in some of these pieces. So they made these recordings available to Pete Seeger, and he decided that he liked this song, which he understood to be Wimmerway. And he decided he was going to record it. All he had to work on was the recording by Solomon Linde. He didn't have any sheet music or anything like that. So he had to transcribe from the sound recording. And to his ear, the mbube, as articulated on the Solomon Linde's record, sounded like Wimmerway, and hence he called the song Wimmerway. And it became very famous, made the hit parades in the 50s. And then at a later stage, it was taken by a group called the Tokens, and they decided they wanted to put words to it. If you would have heard on Pete Seeger's version that the only word really was Wimmerway. And so anyway, the Tokens decided they wanted to have proper lyrics to the song, so they approached George Weiss, who was a very famous American songwriter at the time, and they commissioned him to write words for the music, which he did. And they brought out this song, which they called The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And in that guise, it became extremely famous. It just seemed to be evergreen. It kept on coming back every few years and made it to the hit parades all around the world, in the UK, in Europe, America. And it's probably been one of the most successful pop songs ever written. Then when Walt Disney decided to make a stage production of The Lion King, they decided to put this piece of music into The Lion King. Most of the music for The Lion King was written by Elton John, but they wanted to use this particular piece, and they did, and it then became part of The Lion King. And as part of the soundtrack of The Lion King, it had yet another lease of life. So it just keeps on going forever. And a journalist by the name of Rion Milan somehow cottoned on to the story that this mbube had undergone these evolutions into the Lion King. And but what ought to have happened is that the original composer or his descendants should have made lots of money out of the song. In fact, hadn't happened at all. And the song was not known to come from South Africa. And moreover, the family of the composer, Solomon Linde, died in 1962. So all of this happened quite a few years later, but his family had four daughters at that stage, were living in absolute poverty in Soweto. And Rion Milan considered this to be a great social injustice, that the person who had composed this song should not have, he died in poverty as it happens, he should not have gained any material benefit, and his family equally so, and they were living in abject poverty. And it just seemed all wrong to him that a song that had been so successful and had generated so many millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, should have not been shared with the true originators of it. And he wrote this article, which appeared in a magazine called Rolling Stone, American magazine, which is sort of the gospel of the entertainment industry. And obviously, the magazine was available in South Africa, and it appeared in around about the end of the 1990s. And it caused quite a furore in South Africa because it generated a lot of indignation that this South African family and the South African origins of the song should have been completely ignored. And Gallo, who was the record company that made the record in the first place and sort of sold it off to America, so to speak, at the time had become a sort of a socially conscious company, and they didn't seem to come out of this smelling too well. So they decided that they wanted to see if they could do something to rectify the situation. Now, I, as an attorney, had acted for Gallo for a few years before that. I was talking about around about 2000 now. And they came to me and they said to me, look, this is the history. Here's Rion Milan's article. is there something that we can do about this in retrospect to try and get some material benefit for the family? And they dumped on me a mountain of documents and said, this is everything we have in our records regarding the song. Please go through it all and tell us whether there's anything that can be done. Well, to me, at the outset, it seemed like an absolute lost cause, because what had happened was that in the 1950s, Solomon Linde had assigned his copyright. He transferred his copyright to Geller for the princely sum of 10 shillings. And normally when you assign your copyright in a work, that's it. You kiss the work goodbye, and whatever else happens to it, it's gone. It's like selling your house. Once you've sold your house, you no longer have any control of it. And so I was not at all hopeful that there was any solution to this problem, but I undertook the task of going through this whole mountain of documents. And it took me many hours. While reading through these documents, suddenly a thought struck me, and that is that I had done a doctorate in copyright law about 10 years previously, and I had come across a very strange clause of the Copyright Act, which prevailed in South Africa from 1916 to 1965, during the time when this song was written. It was, in fact, the British Copyright Act of 1911. By a sort of a historical quirk, our Parliament in 1916 decided that the best way to regulate the law of copyright was just to take the British Act, holus bolus, and make it an annexure to an act in our country and say, well, that's our law of copyright.
We'll just adopt it.
Yeah. Mm. This British Act was known as the Imperial Copyright Act because the British had decided to legislate it, or try and have it legislated, all throughout their empire and Commonwealth.
So, Owen, I mean, here you're faced with a villain, as it were, almost, who's looking to rectify a social wrong, possibly, that had occurred long, long before you entered the scene. An extraordinary story of Solomon Linde, who worked at Gallo in the 30s and then recorded this song and then died in poverty. And his family, as you say, also living in poverty, against the background of Solomon Linde and his singing group, the Songbirds, in Sophia Town, that wonderful, vibrant musical background. And there was nothing to show for it as far as the family was concerned. And yet there was all this churning out of money going on in the States. So this is what you were asked to investigate.
Yeah, and why I was mentioning the British legislation, which prevailed in South Africa at the time, is that it had a very strange clause. And that was that 25 years after the death of the author or composer — the term the Copyright Act uses is the author — normally the term of copyright is the lifetime of the author plus 50 years. So there's a 50-year period after the death when the copyright continues to subsist. Now, this provision in the British Act said that 25 years after the death, in other words, at which time there's another 25 years still to run, the copyright, no matter what might have happened to it in the meantime, reverts to the heirs of the original composer. And this thought struck me, and I thought, well, this actually fits the whole scenario perfectly, because 25 years after Solomon Linde's death, 1962, that took us to 1987, the copyright actually reverted back to the family. So the family were in a position to control all use of Mbube, plus derivatives of Mbube. So Wim Away and The Lion Sleeps Tonight, all having been derived from Mbube, the copyright owner, the family, was in a position to control the use of all of those songs. And not only in South Africa, but in any country that was a member of the British Empire or Commonwealth, because that same piece of legislation operated throughout the Commonwealth. So suddenly I realized that, contrary to my initial expectations, the family were potentially sitting on a gold mine, and that there was something really concrete and beneficial which could be done for them. And I reported that to Gallo. I prepared a long written opinion for them and reported that there is this possibility that, if necessary, litigation could be conducted to establish the point that the family was in a position to control all use of Mbube, Wimbawe, and the Lion Sleeps Tonight.
And all the implications of that discovery. Now, to take the story one step further, Ern, let's listen to the next two recordings of that song, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and then it in its guise of The Lion King, where it's sung by two of the characters in The Lion
That's
King,
correct.
The hippopotamus and somebody else.
I'll bow to your superior knowledge.
So let's listen to those two versions to take the story one step further.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. Near the village, the peaceful village, the lion sleeps tonight. Near the village, the quiet village, the lion sleeps tonight.
So there we heard two later versions of what we now know as The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And Ern Mbube, of course, means lion in Zulu. Is that right? So those two versions we've just heard are derivatives of the original Mbube, which we heard earlier on, which was written by Solomon Linda. Owen Dean is in the studio with us this evening, telling us the intriguing story of the copyright case arising from the authorship of the original song, Mbube. Owen, I must mention at this stage, you were recently approached by Tafelberg to write a book about this saga. This has just been launched as an e-book on the Kalahari and Leisure Book sites under the title Awakening the Lion. So for those listeners who are as intrigued by the story as I am, you can read it all at your leisure by finding the e-book on those sites. So on to the next chapter. Now, nothing happened after you deliver.